is the case of Gallegos versus Malco Enterprises, doing business as Budget Rent-A-Car. It is case number 55633. As soon as the parties have positioned themselves at council tables, we'll proceed. Good morning, Council. Are you ready to proceed? Very well.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Joel Henriot, R. Todd Terry. On behalf of plaintiff and appellant Pedro Gallegos as assignee of David Gonzalez, this is an appeal from an order granting. I'm sorry, before I continue, I would like to reserve at least 3 minutes
of
time for rebuttal. This is an appeal from an order granting a motion to dismiss shortly after the complaint was filed on the legal conclusion that the assignment of claims that Judge Gates had granted in execution was invalid. And so
let me just stop you right there. Judge Gates used 21330 as a basis to allow the assignment, correct?
That is the one that he enumerated. I don't think that his decision to do that should be strictly limited to that basis, but I think it was appropriate under that statute, and it is the statute that he cited in the order.
And it's more or less a third-party statute as opposed. I ask you that because 21080 appears to be a more appropriate vehicle to do that, and you know, it seems like this has been carried on through Judge Silver's disposition of it, and I just wanted to know your thoughts on why 21080 isn't a more appropriate statute to allow the assignment.
I think that it is wholly appropriate, and I think that the two are linked. I think that it is 21080 that makes a chosen action an asset subject to execution in the first place. And then when there is a third party involved and an assignment necessary to get at that, then I think you go to the next step, which is 21.330, which allows the district court in that execution process, it authorizes the district court to authorize the judgment creditor to pursue those claims against a third party who may hold the other, who may be indebted to the judgment creditor. And I think that the law clearly deems a chosen action to be a type of debt. Just for example, we grant prejudgment interest not from the time that a judgment is entered, but from the time that a complaint is filed, because the law deems the tortfeasor to owe that debt from the instigation of the case at the latest. But it's a debt. So I think 21080 under that's what makes the chosen action as personal property executable in the first place, especially when you recognize the general definition of personal property applicable to that statute, and that is in NRS 1045, which defines personal property to include money, goods, chattels, and things in action. The Nevada State Constitution also recognizes choses in action as personal property. The exemptions enumerated in 21090 does not exempt choses in action. There is one specific mention in Chapter 21 of choses in action, and in that specific instance, it says that you can't execute on a chosen action if it's held by a particular kind of trust. But I think that it would only make sense to to construe the chapter then as a whole if it is going to specify a very particular instance in which a chosen action would not be subject to execution, to read that as a recognition that it is allowed in the general sense. And then, of course, this court has also said before in the SportsGo Enterprises case that the general rule that if an interest is subject to assignment, it is subject to execution. And choses and action are subject to assignment and therefore to execution. So once it became executable and we set up the judgment debtor's exam, there was a subpoena, he failed to appear for that. And of course we had even warned, and this is in the record, we had warned Budget's counsel that we were going to be taking that judgment debtor's exam and that we were going to be seeking an assignment, that we then went to Judge Gates as a consequence of him having failed to appear, and we got an order, an assignment authorizing us to go after what we had a right to go after and seek in the judgment debtor's exam. So I think that it was entirely correct and certainly not unjust for this assignment to be given in the first place. I think the second question then is the second sentence in 21.330, which purportedly authorized Judge Silver to decide whether or not to modify or vacate this in the first place. And I think the problem there is that there are, and this is a statute that is about 100 year old, so it's not the perfect example of clarity. There are two types of orders that are addressed in 21.330. The first is the assignment. It's the authorization to go after the third party in order to seek the possessions that the third party holds and is indebted to the judgment debtor. And that is really nothing more than an assignment. It is authorization to go and prove a case to get those things. And then there is a second order that it authorizes, essentially a pre-judgment writ of attachment that the court in the supplementary proceedings can grant until the judgment creditor is able to prove up that second case, initiate that action, and pursue it to a judgment. And I think it is a better reading of that statute to say that the district court in a subsequent action can vacate or modify what is essentially a pre-judgment writ of attachment. Because otherwise, the first type of order, which we have here, did not affect the rights of Budget or Budget's insurance companies to any extent at all. They owed that debt to the judgment debtor, Mr. Gallegos. They breached their contract with him. There was bad faith. And if there wasn't genuine insurance that he bought when he was charged $12.95 a day and agreed to pay it, and Budget knew that there was not genuine insurance that he was buying, then there was fraud. But they're tortfeasors that are indebted. They were indebted to him after the assignment. They became indebted to the assignee. But it did not change their obligations under the law. Judge Gates did not enter a judgment against any of the respondents. He merely assigned the rights that had belonged to Gonzalez to Mr. Gallegos, the judgment creditor. It did not affect their rights. We still have to go and prove this case. We still have to prove breach of contract. We still have to prove bad faith. And so while there are complaints about notice, and I think that even those complaints ring hollow when you consider that we did put them on notice that we were going forward with this judgment creditors, with the judgment debtors exam and what we would be seeking. I don't think that it is dispositive that they were not on notice of the actual proceedings where Judge Gates granted the assignment, because again, it didn't fundamentally affect their rights at all. What they owed, they simply owed to another. If there had been a voluntary assignment, they would not have been entitled to notice of those proceedings. I don't know if the court has any questions about the release. When Mr. Gallegos entered that release, he specifically reserved this option to be able to go against Mr. Gonzalez. It was clear that was all that was it, all that was at issue in the release was Budget's responsibility under the Financial Responsibility Act. But the assignment was correct. The assignment was correct. There was nothing unjust about it. And the policy in this state, as reflected in Buck versus Greyhound and behind the Financial Responsibility Act, is to try to make sure that there is some recourse for injured tort victims. Here, counsel has jumped through every hoop that could be set up to get at that policy that Mr. Gallegos paid his $12.95 a day for. He paid it, and then when he tried to get it, he was left out in the cold, and actually Budget and Knight Management negotiated for themselves a release and specifically left him subject to a second lawsuit.
So you're just simply saying that Judge Silver erred when she refused to recognize what you're describing as a legitimate assignment.
Precisely.
But it wasn't brought to her attention, 21080, that allows causes of action to be assigned.
What was brought to her attention, when I think that they are linked, I think 21.330 is just that component of the chapter within the framework that allows that. But cited prominently before her was the Denim case, the California Denim case versus Denim versus Farmers Insurance, which construes Nevada law, which is a guess at what this court would hold in very similar circumstances, and it walks through this same statutory scheme. It walks through 21.080, the definition of personal property in 10.0.
Well, counsel, is your argument, you're equating a choice of action to the language in the statute that says indebted to the judgment debtor?
In 21.330, yes. It would fall under
you're
that
equating,
definition.
Yes. You're equating a chosen action.
A chosen action is a debt contemplated in that section, especially when you consider that it shares a chapter with 21080.
I have one other question. The judge, in granting summary judgment, appeared to, in most of the order at least, base it on the fact that she felt that Judge Gates' assignment order was improper under 21330. In paragraph 10, though, she appears to have also granted summary judgment based on the scope of the release. Did she reach the release question or not? I mean, I'm not sure why it was necessary to reach the release question, but it appears the order did so. So she granted summary judgment on both grounds. Is that the case?
Analytically, I don't think she did reach that. I agree that she didn't have to reach that. I think the reason that it's in the order is because it's common practice in the 8th Judicial District to invite the prevailing party to draft the conclusions of law and the order. I think that even under the release, summary judgment was inappropriate. Where under the release, all that Mr. Gallego, or all that
in the motion practice, did you litigate the scope of the release?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
So it appears she reached it.
Yes.
In the written order.
She did reach it. Whether or not she had to, right? She didn't, but she did reach it. She did at least address it. Similarly was incorrect for the reasons that we have argued in our brief, that when Mr. Gallegos released anyone, he only released Budget, he only released Knight Management, and that was only to the $15,000 that they were obligated to pay as a matter of law under the Financial Responsibility Act. But it expressly reserved the right to go against Mr. Gonzalez and his insurers. And here, this case is Mr. Gonzalez's. We stand in his shoes. These are his claims. And there is no release in the release of Mr. Gonzalez's breach of contract, bad faith, and fraud claims. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hamrick.
May it please the Court. Justin Carley for the respondents in this appeal. Respectfully, there is but one issue on appeal here, and that is whether Judge Silver's summary judgment ruling was proper. To answer that question, there are two sub-issues: whether she was within her authority under NRS 21.330 to review the Gates order, and second, under that authority, whether she properly reviewed and vacated the order. Now, because this standard of review is de novo, this court can decide that question anew. Did NRS 21.330 authorize...
Well, as you've set up the issues, counsel, did she release... Did she reach the release and the scope of the release or not?
She did. And she did so as sort of the third reason justifying her ruling. She first said this order was improper. She next said this issue was already heard by Judge Kadish on summary judgment 2 years earlier, in which the release was substantively briefed. And she third said, and I have this release in which you've already released these claims against these defendants. So her analysis was threefold. And she did that for a series of reasons. She recognized that these respondents had already settled with Pedro Gallegos. She recognized that these respondents already paid Pedro Gallegos. Recognized that Judge Kadish had issued summary judgment on the language of the release 2 years earlier, and that summary judgment was not appealed. And the reason why it wasn't appealed was Mr. Gallegos went back to Judge Gates in the suit that was only against Mr. Gonzalez and got the order allowing them to resue for a second time the parties who had already won on summary judgment. That's why the release...
But they're not the plaintiffs.
The plaintiffs... We moved...
Mr. Gonzalez is the plaintiff.
Mr. Gonzalez, in the...
In your case, Mr. Gonzalez is the plaintiff.
Mr. Gonzalez is identified as the plaintiff. When that second suit was filed, we moved for a more definite statement asking exactly who counsel represented, Pedro Gallegos or David Gonzalez. Judge Silver granted that motion, required them to amend and state exactly who was who and who was asserting what claims. And at that hearing, Mr. Terry argued he was only representing Mr. Gonzalez in his capacity under the assignment from Judge Gates. He does not represent him individually. Mr. Gonzalez never presented claims for breach of contract, breach of fiduciary duty, unfair claims practices act. Those claims were never presented to us by our insured. And there's a key distinction between the insurer, Knight Management, and the rental car agency, Budget. Many of the arguments in the briefing tend to conflate the two and treat them as one. That key distinction was important to Judge Silver and Judge Kadish because he said this release applies to both of them. Regardless of what claims you're asserting against the insurance company or the rental car agency, you release them all.
But didn't it specifically reference the Nevada Financial Responsibility Act?
It did.
And so wasn't it focused on that aspect of the claim?
That is one paragraph in the release.
Correct.
The release contains numerous paragraphs. It identifies the released parties as both the rental car agency and the insurance company, and that was the product of the settlement. The way the Nevada Financial Responsibility Act works is that the rental car agency can be secondarily liable after a judgment is obtained against its driver. Now, that liability could be joint and several if it didn't ensure that insurance was in place, or it could be limited to the amount of the bond if they had that bond in place. But up front, Mr. Gallegos' counsel negotiated with both the insurance company under the rental liability insurance policy and the rental car agency and got a universal release for those parties. There is one paragraph that says, as it applies to Budget, the rental car agency, it relieves them under the Nevada Financial Responsibility Act. But there are numerous other paragraphs where it discusses how it releases any and all claims, known, unknown, asserted, unasserted, against both parties.
But isn't that paragraph an express reservation?
That paragraph was an express reservation for this reason. The driver may have his own insurance, separate from Budget's bond and separate from the renter's liability insurance that he purchased. Now, they went and they sued him separately, and he was represented by counsel. It wasn't a mere default judgment. The default judgment came when he failed to participate in his own defense because he failed to appear for a deposition twice. That's where that default judgment came. At that point, he has waived any bad faith claims against the insurer, and he has already settled them anyway. And this was all in front of Judge Kadish. This was argued and ruled on in 2008. It was only after the assignment under 21.330 that we had the new suit with Judge Silver, and her determination was narrow. It was, did this statute allow you to get this order after you already lost summary judgment and after you already settled without giving them notice that this is what you were seeking? And she said, no, that wasn't just. It wasn't just because you already settled, because you already lost summary judgment. You used Judge Gates as an appellate court to get an order allowing you to redo what you tried to do the first time. And that is not what this statute is designed to do. When you look at the plain language of this statute, it says it applies to property or debt. It does not say it applies to an unassertive claim for relief. And that's a key distinction, because as we were talking about 21.080 earlier, you asked the question if a claim for relief or a cause of action is property when it's a little bit different between the two statutes. And we have a Nevada Supreme Court case from 1982, Chafee versus Smith, that says an unasserted claim for relief is not subject to assignment or execution. That Supreme Court in 1982 reserved the ruling on whether an actual asserted claim for relief would be subject to assignment or execution. And that's not what we have here. We have an unasserted claim for relief. David Gonzalez never sued either Budget or the insurance company for bad faith, breach of contract, or the other claims that are in the new complaint. It's a key distinction, because if we allow 21.330 to be used this way, we'll never have any finality. We'll have parties settle, parties win summary judgment, and still always be on the hook if in some other suit that they're not a party to, the judgment creditor can get an order like this. And it's not clear how this order was obtained, because the application is not public record. It was filed ex parte. And it was filed because David Gonzalez didn't appear at a judgment debtor exam, just like he didn't appear at his depositions. So they applied for order to show cause why Mr. Gonzalez shouldn't be held in contempt. And when he was held in contempt, this paragraph gets snuck in that says, pursuant to 21.330, you can sue the parties that you've already released and that you've already sued and lost summary judgment against. That cannot be what the statute is designed to accomplish.
Well, did you argue in your answering brief that the claim is not a chosen action under 21.080?
We did not, and there's a simple reason. Appellant's brief claims 21.330 never applied in the first place. In fact, I was surprised to see that in their reply brief, because that is the exact statute that Judge Gates' order says it was entered pursuant to. Pursuant, as you quoted earlier, pursuant to NRS 21.330, Gallegos may sue in Gonzalez's name for a list of claims. So we look at 21.330, and we say, well, this doesn't apply to an unasserted claim for relief. That's what we argued in our response brief.
Well, and again, weren't the prior summary judgments that were granted were based upon the fact that he didn't have a third-party complaint?
That's why the distinction between...
And once there was an assignment, it takes on all different character.
It takes on different properties, but that's the distinction between the rental car agency and the insurance company. Nevada doesn't allow a third-party complaint against the insurance company. It does against the rental car agency if the rental car agency failed to provide coverage. But we're smushing the two together and saying, well, it doesn't matter if you released them both already, and it doesn't matter if they paid you. Now that you have a judicial assignment under a statute that didn't apply, even though you already lost your suit, we're going to expand it back up, and we're going to let you sue those parties again.
Standing in somebody else's shoes.
Standing in somebody else's shoes.
As a first party.
A first party who never asserted the claim. And that is the key distinction. That's the Chafee versus Smith case. A chosen action is inaction. If there was a lawsuit pending, they could execute against it. We have Ninth Circuit authority saying that a chosen action is a species of property, but it does not vest until there is an actual suit or a judgment. You can't invent the claim for relief on behalf of someone and then assert it. And that's why the Chafee versus Smith opinion is so important. It says the unasserted claim for relief is not assignable. And that's why it was improper under NRS 21.330. Unless there are any further questions, I will cede the rest of my time with this last proposition. If we're discussing the release, if we're discussing the stacked insurance scheme under Hall and Salas, we're allowing the appeal of Judge Silver's order to be an appeal of Judge Kadish's order 2 years earlier, long after the appellate deadline passed for that order. We're also if we accept their position and allow the statute to be used this way, going to exponentially increase the amount of litigation because there will never be any finality. It wouldn't matter if you settled, it wouldn't matter if you won, you'd always have to look out for this statute allowing someone to get an order and come right back at you without notice to you. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Carley. Mr. Henriette, in response. Strike that, in rebuttal.
I will be brief.
just a few points. The idea that a chosen action only counts as property once it's been filed is not the law, which is why no authority was cited for that. If you look, for example, at the Denham case in California, that case it had not been initiated yet. Also, reference was made to the negotiation process on the release. In the district court, it was asserted that the release was unambiguous, and so the parole evidence didn't matter. But now that we are into the negotiation process, you have in the record, in volume one of the appendix, pages 108 to 109, and page 118, the correspondence between Mr. Terry and counsel for budget and night management, where Mr. Terry is saying, but there's both the $15,000 under Financial Responsibility Act, and then Mr. Gonzalez also paid his $12.95 for additional coverage. There appears to be $30,000, to which counsel for Knight responds, we are also willing not to include our insured's name in the release so that it does not prevent you from going after our insured or possible additional insurance coverage that he may have.
Counsel, is the judge's decision granting summary judgment on the basis of the release properly before the appellate court? I don't recognize that as an issue you've raised on appeal.
It is not one of the issues enumerated in the issues presented section. It is fully briefed, at least in the opening brief, so it is essentially presented for appeal. And again, it is not clear from the order of the district court that that was dispositive to begin.
Well, and I guess that takes me back to a point that was made. If Judge Kadish, in fact, made a determination on the release, and that determination was never appealed.
I think the determination that Judge Kadish made is that Mr. Gallegos's claims in his own shoes were precluded by the release. But nothing in Judge Kadish's decision held that Mr. Gonzalez did not have claims, or that he was not able to pursue Mr. Gonzalez's claims if he could obtain that assignment. Her ruling was only that Mr. Gallegos, in his own shoes, could not, because of the way that was drafted. And while I do think that was incorrect, we didn't appeal it at the time, and I don't think that it is dispositive, because again, we are pursuing different claims, not claims adjudicated by Judge Kadish's order.
Thank you, Mr. Henry. Thank you, counsel. We'll take a very brief recess and return for the 11:30 hour.